Okay, today is March 15th, 2013. This is an interview with Dr. Wyatt T. Walker. My name, the interviewer, is Evan Falkenbury, and we're in Chester, Virginia. So, Dr. Walker, can you first just begin by describing your childhood, where you were born, and your family and background?
I was born in Brockton, Massachusetts, and stayed there until I was a couple of years old. Mm-hmm. And my father moved to South Jersey. That's where I grew up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was Mechanicsville, New Jersey?
Merchantsville,
I'm sorry. So in Merchantsville, was that the place of middle school and high school and education?
Yes.
Like that? Okay.
I went to segregated elementary school and integrated junior high and integrated high school.
Mm-hmm. So what was the atmosphere in your integrated high school at that period in time in New Jersey?
I can't say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's fine. So your university education was at Virginia Union.
Yes, I didn't think I would ever go to college, but my parents mortgaged their life insurance so I could go.
Wow. And you arrived, what year was it that you arrived at Virginia
Union? 1946.
1946. And according to some of the notes, you were a double major. Is that correct?
Right, chemistry and physics.
Right, right.
I thought I was going to be a physician.
Right. So what steered you away from being a physician?
Well, the pull of the ministry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then?
And the racial situation I met in the South.
Sure.
I saw the ministry as a means of combating segregation and injustice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for your seminary education, you stayed at Virginia Union, is that correct?
At the graduate school, yes.
Right. How else, or in what other ways were you involved on campus at Virginia Union with the early movement or anything else?
With the college, chapter of NAACP,
mm-hmm.
And I didn't ride the streetcars because they were segregated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were there protests against the streetcars being segregated?
Not formally.
Mm-hmm.
Individually.
So individual decisions to not subject yourselves to that kind of situation.
If you didn't sit segregated, you had to get off.
Mm-hmm.
And I got put off many streetcars.
Right, right. So you described the ministry as what you joined to better fight for,
right,
for racial rights, for civil rights. So in what other ways did your education prepare you for your lifetime of ministry and civil rights activism?
I had a liberal education, and I was steeped in Negro history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the kind of black history that was a major influence.
Very positive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cause it wasn't very well taught in places outside of black institutions at that time.
Right.
Right. So after you obtained your ministry degree in graduate school, how long was it until you began working or serving at Guilfield?
Well, I went to Guilfield my senior year.
Okay.
So it was right away.
Okay. Can you describe some of the early work at Guilfield as a young seminary student transitioning to working at?
I had become the pastor of the church, mm-hmm. and I became the president of the NAACP branch, and I was state director of Congress for Racial Equality, and I founded the Petersburg Improvement Association, which was modeled after the MIA in Montgomery.
So, with the PIA specifically, in what ways did the PIA challenge segregation in Petersburg?
Economic boycott, protests against the library, and picketing, public protests.
Mm-hmm. How did you measure the results of PIA's activism?
Well, we were successful in integrating the library, mm-hmm. and we desegregated the lunch counters and the chain stores.
Right.
Those were the two major results.
Right. So, were you arrested often?
One time in Petersburg.
One time in Petersburg. Mm-hmm. Can you describe that?
I went in the white section of the public library, and that was. They put me in jail, and I wouldn't pay the bail, and I stayed in jail three days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was the jail experience for you?
Terrible. Filthy. Food wasn't good.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the guards were hurt. You know, rude and nasty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was their treatment of you similar to how, or let me say, what was the wider treatment that whites in Petersburg at that time gave to blacks in town?
It was second class all the way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very pronounced.
It was very evident.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Everything was segregated, even the ministerial union.
Mm-hmm. So the time you were, I read when you were arrested at the library, what was the book that you were trying to check out?
I asked for volume one of Douglas F. Wells Freeman. Biography of Robert E. Lee.
Right. And why that book?
I don't know. I just thought I was being smart.
What was the reaction of when people learned that that was the book you wanted to check?
They were flabbergasted.
Not expecting it. So at that same time, you mentioned you were working with the NAA and with CORE.
Right.
So how was your, I know it was related, but in what capacity did you serve the NAA and CORE?
I was president of the local branch, and at CORE I was the organizer across the state.
Okay. Were those heavy duties?
Not really.
Really?
Not for me.
Why is that?
It was just my natural bent.
Did the NAA and CORE have large membership in Virginia at the time, or the local?
Not really. They were like outposts.
Right. Right. So, maybe moving on towards your service with SCLC, can you describe maybe first how you met and came to know Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
He was in seminary at Crozier in Chester, Pennsylvania, and I was president of my seminary class, and he was president of his seminary class, so it was a natural reaction as we worked in the inter-seminary movement. We would, our seminary was the host for the Mid-Atlantic meeting, and that's how I met him. He came as a delegate.
Okay. Where was that meeting?
At Virginia Union.
Okay. So, did you immediately become friends, or was it a slow progress?
Yeah, I think we both bonded each other. We were both preacher's sons and preparing for the ministry, so it was natural attraction.
So can you describe the formation of SCLC and how you were a part of that?
Well, I started out with the ministers as the members of the board of directors, and I joined it and became one. But it was aimed at freeing the vote and fighting against injustice. And its methodology was nonviolence, introduced to it by Dr. King.
The earliest SCLC was made up entirely or almost entirely of ministers?
Almost. Ministers in their churches.
So, how did... Or let me ask, what kind of work did you do for SCLC in Virginia before you became executive director?
I was just SCLC's man in Virginia, and I represented Dr. King whenever I could.
What sort of, as a representative of SCLC in Virginia, what did those duties involve?
Support generally for any fight against segregation.
Can you describe the events that led to your becoming executive director?
Well, Dr. King had noticed my organizational skills in Petersburg, and he was impressed with what we did in our PIA, so he wanted me to take that organizational thrust and spread it across the South.
So when you became executive director, what sort of state did you find the organization in at the time when you began?
It was just beginning.
Right.
And it was more an idea in Dr. King's briefcase than it was an organization. And so I was on the ground floor of its organization.
So,
When I went there, it made 5 employees. I took 2 with me from Petersburg. And my first budget was $57,000. When I left 4 years later, the budget was over $1 million, and we had 100 people working for SCLC. we had become a major civil rights organization.
Right. So what were those early, what did you do early on to begin the process of turning SCLC into a major organization?
My instinct was to invest Dr. King's image into the organization. It seemed to me that was important, and we did that. They would talk about Dr. King, but they never talked about the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and I thought it should be the other way around.
So did you, when you first started, did you face resistance from those already in SCLC?
No. They were completely cooperative.
Did you sense that they shared your vision to enhance the name of SCLC?
Dr. King did, and they did. Dr. King was the leader, and really what he said went.
Right, so people still looked. He was still recognized as the ultimate authority figure at that time?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I also read that as you were the executive director, I've also seen you mentioned as Dr. King's chief of staff. Were those roles the same or different?
Exactly.
They were exactly the same? Okay.
In other words, Dr. King would give me assignments, and I had to see that they were done, and I did it through the staff.
Okay. I see. So, working for SCLC, in what ways were you active in the movement outside of the office, as far as protesting and that kind of thing?
Not very much, because I had to take care of a bit of the organization.
Right.
But I was always ready to participate.
Right. Well, you, at one point, participated in a freedom ride.
That was later, a couple of years later.
Within the Albany movement, around that time?
The Albany movement, before the Albany movement.
Yeah, let me back up before we get there. So, the work that you were doing with SCLC was in large part to raise money.
Administration.
And administration, right. For the fundraising aspect, in what ways did you begin to raise money that was different?
Well, Dr. King would go to, say, Houston and come back with $1,000. And I thought that was not a good use of his time. And I developed a pamphlet, a book of 21 pages of how to promote a Martin Luther King rally. And we used that. And we took in 10 times more. And I developed a donors list, direct mail approach, and we did 10 times the fundraising that way after I got there than we had done before.
So the new policies you put in really worked.
Oh, absolutely.
When you sent this information out,
I had a skin grab. That's why I'm. And it's very sensitive.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry. I was sorry to hear about that. And whenever you need to pause or stop, please let me know. So within the fundraising work, did you find when you were sending out the information before Dr. King traveled, Were people receptive to your new fundraising tactics?
I designed a Dollars for Freedom envelope with his picture on it, and that increased the income. People put more in an envelope than they will if they just get something in the basket.
Right. So just some of these were just simple changes, but they had
far-reaching impact and results.
Right. Right. So SCLC in raising all of the money, where was the money then being spent, some of the ways?
In personnel and in helping local communities with their fight against injustice.
Within those local communities, fighting injustice was a major part of that voter registration?
Yes, in the beginning it was. But the more we protested, the more resistance we met. So we had to deal with bail money and that kind of thing.
Right.
And people getting hurt.
So SCLC money was going to bail money and also to medical bills, voting, registration. So was all of this expensive, or in what ways?
It cost money to do anything.
Right.
We had to have personnel, had to have people in the field. And you had to have things to work with, you know, flyers and we funded the citizenship schools. We made proposals to the Church of Christ and to the Taconic Foundation. And we got grants and participated.
You mentioned the Taconic Foundation. What was SCLC's relationship with Taconic?
Well, we made a proposal to them for voter registration, which became the Voter Education Project, headed by Wally Branton. Steve Currier, the CEO, was lost somewhere in the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah, in an airplane. So, did you find that Taconic and Stephen Currier?
Very receptive.
They were receptive. So, and you also mentioned the Voter Education Project. Can you describe the beginning of SCLC's relationship with VEP?
Well, we were just one of the organizations involved. It was the NAACP Corps and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
So, did VEP provide, or how much money did VEP provide to SCLC?
None to us as such. We just participated in the program.
And what was the specific program?
To get black people registered. To try to change the government in the South.
In your opinion, while you were in charge of SCLC, did you see VEP and, I guess, the Southern Regional Council as effective in what they were doing?
They were doing the best they could. It didn't matter much. The VEP program didn't go forward. Southern Regional Council was mainly talking. but it wasn't changing the scenery.
Mm-hmm. Did you have personal relationships with some of the people over at SRC, Southern Regional Council?
Oh, absolutely. And Leslie Dunbar, mm-hmm, and others. I can't remember the names now.
You mentioned Wiley Branton as well.
Yeah, Wiley Branton. I knew him pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. But in your opinion, VEP and SRC, they weren't on the front lines.
That's right.
They were, I guess. Did you see them as more of a support group?
Well, working toward the same goals, but not an activist organizations.
Mm-hmm. So, in your role as executive director, did you see yourself as being the one to make the tough decisions?
Sometimes.
And what did that look like?
I mainly tried to do what Dr. King wanted done. If he made me an assignment, my job was to get the ball over the goal line.
Mm-hmm. Right. Can you describe? Oh, that's okay. That's quite all right. I can grab that.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Don't worry about it. Let's see. Oh, hi. Fine. It's still going, so no problem. You mentioned before the Albany movement. I wonder if we can go back there and you can describe how SCLC became involved and what was happening in Albany.
Well, the students had, SNCC folks had gone there and laid the groundwork and got a movement started. But they found out they were in over their heads, and they knew Dr. King would attract the national media and bring some money. So they asked him to join them, and we did. And he took along some of his veteran staff. And then the organizational rivalry caused friction, and NAACP and the local community and SCLC, and They had picked too many targets. They were just against anything segregated. Mm-hmm. And it just kept their resources very skimpy and thin. And the community was worn out by the constant protests and going to jail. So the importance of Albany is that we learned how to mobilize an entire community for any assault against segregation. If there had been no Albany, wouldn't have been a Birmingham.
So where did some of that tension between SCLC and SNCC originate? What was the relationship like?
They thought you could just jump up and go to jail. But we had families, car payments, mortgages. We couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. We had to plan ahead. Mm-hmm. And they didn't. They were trigger happy, mm-hmm, if we could use that phrase. Mm-hmm. And it was the old separation of the generations, you know, with a generational gap.
Right. Right. As young people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you said that Birmingham, the kind of protest there would not have happened without Albany. Can you expand on that? What was it that
we learned inspired? How to organize the whole community, and that's what we learned in Albany, and we applied it to the lessons we learned in Albany to Birmingham. And Birmingham became the chief watershed of the nonviolent movement in the South. It led to the 1964 Public Accommodations Act. If there hadn't been a Birmingham, there wouldn't have been a Selma. I talk about have an analysis of the concentric circle development of the movement. Have you seen that?
I think I have, but can you describe it?
You get my book, somebody's calling my name in the room, and I show them the chart.
Okay, thank you. So, I know that you were in large part the strategist,
yes,
of Birmingham.
Of everything.
Right. How specifically did you organize what was to come in Birmingham?
We decided first we would zero in, not on everything, but on the commerce and industry of Birmingham. And that involved a boycott, and it involved demonstrations and jailings.
Did you, before the demonstrations began, did you travel to Birmingham?
I went a year ahead of time.
Okay, and what did you do during that?
I picked the targets of our protests. I counted the stools in the lunch counters, and identified the secondary targets and the tertiary targets, and predicted that Bull Connor would do something stupid that would help us, and he did. Okay.
So, what you mentioned, Bull Connor. What was it about Bull Connor that made you know that he was going to cause something?
First, he was ignorant, and he was also a racial bigot.
What was the reaction of the local community in Birmingham to SCLC?
Slow at first,
really?
But we had Fred Shuttlesworth and his Alabama, his organization was our strongest affiliate.
Oh, that's the chart. Yeah, I have seen this. So the core was the Montgomery bus protest.
Yes. It's like throwing a rock in the water.
Right.
And it just developed. That's how the movement developed.
Right. After the Montgomery bus protest, according to your chart, then the sit-in movement, then the Freedom Rides, then Albany, then Birmingham, then Selma, then Chicago, and then the anti-Vietnam campaigns. And then finally, the Poor People's Campaign, right? Which, right. That's, it sums it up. Thanks for showing me again. So, with the Project C, I guess, in Birmingham, were you on the ground when a lot of the major protests and reactions occurred?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I was a field general.
Mm-hmm. What did that field general? What does that mean?
I decided when a protest would take place and who would go and what. You know.
Right.
I took care of the details. The use of children was a part of my responsibility. James Bevel and I felt we should use children.
Right.
Dr. King wasn't so sure because of the criticism that would leave it against him. Bobby, scratch my back, please.
So how did the campaign use children?
Well, we had the children's march, and the television accounts of them using the water hoses on the children. Mm-hmm. It just swayed public opinion. Mm-hmm. Right there in the center. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember how long you were in Birmingham, or how long the campaign lasted?
About a month and a half.
And when it ended, did you feel that it was a good time to 39 end?
39 days, oh yeah.
39.
We got the truce.
Right.
And the signs came down.
Right.
My wife is a veteran of Birmingham.
I read that. And then wasn't there also an incident where you were hit? Do you want to describe that? And you can speak as well if you want. If not, it's perfectly fine.
Okay. Well, Dr. King and Reverend Abernathy had gone back to Atlanta, because it was Mother's Day, and they had to be at their respective churches. My husband did not have a church, and so he stayed in Birmingham.
He needed somebody to stay in Birmingham,
mm-hmm.
and I was the person they decided should be there.
Mm-hmm.
So since I couldn't go home, Dr. King said, well, I could bring my wife and the four children over.
Mm-hmm.
That's how she came.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, somebody had bombed A.D.'s house, A.D.?
Yeah.
They did that.
And you went to kind of calm the crowd because of people were upset.
I went out in the city to try to calm them. It was a riot about to start.
And we were at the Gaston Motel.
Mm-hmm.
And the two older children had gone with the Barfield Pendletons. They had a son and a daughter the same age as our children. And this one and the youngest one were with me at the Gaston Motel. And the National Guard came in, and we were sitting out in the courtyard.
Yeah.
The children were asleep inside, and they said everybody had to go into the lobby of the motel. And I said, I have to pick up. My children are asleep in the room. I have to get my children. And he just struck me in the head with the butt of his rifle.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. What happened after that?
Well, I went to the hospital. And I wouldn't go until somebody got my two children, Bobby and Earl, to come with me, because I couldn't leave them at the hotel. Nobody was there to look after.
The hotel had been bombed.
And then I got up in the morning. When I got out of the hospital, I just wanted to get out of there.
Yeah.
So I left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where did you go?
Home, back to Atlanta.
She and the four children were arrested in East Point, Georgia.
After we got to the airport, when we got back to Atlanta.
Right after.
Uh-huh. On Mother's Day. And my oldest child must have been 8 or maybe 9. And we had 4 under that. And they arrested us. Yeah. And I called Gene Young, Andy's wife. I called Dr. Daddy King first, and I couldn't get him because he had left the church. And I called Gene Young. Well, they said, you've had your one phone call. So I said, well, can my daughter have her call? And they said, yes. So on her call, I called Gene Young. And she and his secretary came out to the jail about midnight, and they told him we were not there. Meanwhile, Daddy King had come with someone he knew who owned their property outright. You couldn't have a mortgage on your property for them to put to pay my bail, to put bail up for me. So when Daddy King came, he came and got us out. Mm-hmm. And when I went back to trial, you and Bob Brown were coming from Birmingham, and he saw my car, his car, and he said, oh, I bet my wife is in the jail out here. And sure enough, I was, and they came in and bailed me out because I wouldn't pay. They charged me $84, and I said, well, I'm not going to pay. Yeah. So then they put me in a cell, but it was a clean, nice, clean cell. So I said, okay, I'll get a good rest. But they came and got me out.
What was the charge?
The first charge, when the policeman pulled up beside me, he said, what do you do when you see a police car's lights flashing? I said, you pull over. So he said, you didn't pull over. So that charge was evading arrest. And he told me to follow him to the jail. And then at midnight, when Daddy King came, they had added another car, a charge. I forget what that was. I forget what the other. Oh, the first charge was, they said I was speeding. But I was only two blocks into East Point, was where the airport is.
Right.
And so then when Daddy King came and they released me, they added another charge and said that one said I was evading arrest.
Wow. So did the Atlanta police know who you were?
They knew the car.
Yeah.
So that's why they stopped the car. Maybe they thought he was driving at first, but was, you know, chilled.
Right. Wow. Thanks for sharing. So, moving on with SCLC, or actually before that, can you describe your role in organizing the March on Washington in 1963?
With Abraham Wood from Birmingham, we just contacted communities all across the South. And we were in charge of the Southeast organization.
Right. So you got the word out?
Mm-hmm. And got busloads and car caravans to go. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And at the march, can you describe what you experienced while being there in Washington?
I got up early in the morning and watched the buses coming in from all over the country. From the Midwest, from New York, and from the South. We knew we had to have a large gathering of people for it to be impressive, and that's what we were hoping for. And when the buses started coming in, we were so excited.
Mm-hmm. What?
I'm getting a little tired.
Sure. Let me just ask, how did your relationships change with SCLC in 1963, towards when you were coming to the end of your tenure?
It didn't change.
Mm-hmm.
I left in good grace, mm-hmm. And most people understood. They had frozen my salary at $10,000, and I couldn't make it. And I took a post in New York, which paid me twice that,
right,
and plus some. So,
with the Negro Heritage Library.
Yes. Right. Educational Heritage was the former name of the company.
Right, right. Okay. Well, I think you're getting tired, so that's perfectly fine. So I'll wrap up the interview and just say thank you once again. And let me go ahead and turn this off.